It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
It's time for Pitch Hit and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Give the kids in your community a chance to flex their superpowers and they could earn a trip to the national finals of the 2025 World Series presented by Capital One. So go ahead, be the one who powers their dreams and sign up to host the local Pitch Hit and Run event. It's a free and fun way to promote baseball, softball, and your organization. To learn more, go to pitchhitrun.com.
909. So here's the deal. You got the storm down there, and they're watching it, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen with it other than the time frame of Wednesday to Thursday. We got the debate tomorrow night between Harris and Trump. That's going to be simulcast here on WWL. You can hear it at 8 o'clock. And there's not a damn thing we can do about either one until then, right? So why don't we talk about space? Why don't we look to the final frontier, the great beyond, with our friend Jillian Scudder. Dr. Jillian Scudder, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Oberlin College and author of 3 books on astronomy for the general public, the latest of which is 40 Ways to Know a Star. How you doing, Dr. Scudder?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Might I call you Jillian?
You might.
All right. Will you call me Tommy, please?
I can, yes.
Well, let's now that we've established that, see, that's when they come, and we all know who they are, then that's the kind of communication we have to establish. First thing we have to establish is how to address each other, don't you think?
It will be a challenge, yes.
When the Santi arrive?
When the what?
Santi arrive? You've not been watching Three-Body Problem, have you?
I have not, true.
Oh, Jillian. It's probably kindergarten stuff to you, and it's probably, well, that's not true. But, I'm hooked on that show. Three-Body Problem on Netflix, I think it is. I don't know.
It's one of the streaming sites, for sure.
Yes, and it talks about, you know, it's a long story. I don't want to give anything away, but about the problems that would ensue if you had 3 suns trying to compete for the Earth's gravity, yes?
It would be a problem. It is not a stable situation
that's
in any
it.
Capacity.
And that's the point. It would be about chaos and everything else and periods of chaos and all that stuff. Anyway, let's talk about what's going on with this Starliner.
Yes, it is not going according to plan. So the astronauts were supposed to be up in the ISS for 8 days, and they will now be up there for 8 months. Which is a little bit of an extension by pretty much any set of accounting.
What is the problem? Why did that happen?
Well, so the capsule itself had some issues that they weren't able to figure out what the problem was. And when your spacecraft, which functionally has one job, which is to keep your astronauts safe, starts not doing that so well, everybody gets extremely suspicious. And so to keep the astronauts safe, because we couldn't figure out what was wrong with the capsule, we sent the capsule home empty, and we're keeping the astronauts on the ISS where we know that they will be housed comfortably and not in any danger.
But as it turned out, could we have sent them home, or could they have sent them home?
Unclear. So the capsule did land back on Earth intact, but intact is a different story from safely, internally safe. Because some of the issues seem to be that it was like leaking air, and that's never a good thing.
No, not if you're traveling.
So we never want that.
traveling in a
car. Or even just coming back through the atmosphere. That's not good either.
Or traveling in a car with somebody else with closed windows. But enough of that. Let's talk about your new book. What is 40 Ways to Know a Star about?
40 Ways to Know a Star is slightly as described. It is all about stars and different ways that we can look at them and different things we can understand about them and how much they have taught us about And so some of those things that it's taught us is, you know, how does the sun work? How does the light that we get work? And some of it is, you know, how far away are distant galaxies? So the stars really have taught us things on many scales.
Let me get back to the Starliner. First of all, why is it going to take all of that time until February for them to come back down? Because they have to get another ship ready to go get them, or?
Right. So it's there's sort of scheduled times for different rockets to go up. And so some of those are resupply missions, and they're not equipped to carry humans. And some of them are, you know, we have to get other astronauts back down. And so it did work out just with scheduling problems and when a non-Starliner or non-Boeing craft could come get them, because this was the experimental Boeing craft. And since we don't trust that one at the moment, we're going to get them down some other way. So that was the part of the complication of it. Yeah.
Take me back to NASA, because, you know, back in the day, it was NASA that did the space travel, right? And then mm-hmm. what happened?
Yeah.
How they subcontracted that out, and when did other companies get involved? And what other companies are involved in this?
So we retired the space shuttle, and that was kind of the end of NASA on their own. And the space shuttle was great, but it wildly over-exceeded how long we thought it was going to be operational. And so when this craft started becoming unreliable, it was when they decided, okay, these need to be retired for sure. And so right now, the primary ways that we get astronauts up into space is either we hitch a ride on the Soyuz spacecraft, which are operated by Russia, mm-hmm. or we have SpaceX with the SpaceX capsule, the Dragon capsule. And this was Boeing's attempt to get up and running into that system as well. So in principle, we have SpaceX and Boeing and the Russian Soyuz craft. But in practice, it looks like right now we have SpaceX and the Russian Soyuz craft.
Boeing's had enough trouble with their airplanes, have they not, let alone space travel?
They have, yes. It is a little concerning.
So where does Elon yeah. Musk fit in all of this?
Well, he's involved in SpaceX to some degree, in that he is on the board of directors, but he's also got a lot of other things going on. And I don't think he's directly involved in operations of SpaceX so much anymore. It was true a few years ago. He was more directly involved. But yeah, he's part of the board of directors for SpaceX.
So looking at it from a purely scientific standpoint, does it make sense for the government to contract this out?
Well, from a scientific standpoint, it's very different from an economic standpoint. From a scientific standpoint, I think it would be great if NASA had their own craft that they could send up. But a lot of NASA's budget is wrapped up in things like other uncrewed missions. So we have things like they're operating the Mars rovers, and they're operating the Hubble Space Telescope and a lot of other telescopes. And so they do a lot of launches of equipment and machinery and maintenance work on those machines that is not launching crew to the ISS. I think it would be great if we had something like the space shuttle again, where we could put really large instruments and things up into space again. Part of the reason the ISS was able to be built was because the big pieces of it fit inside the space shuttle, which we no longer have the capacity to do. But it's really come down to funding more than science.
See, but I guess the way I look at it, Doctor, is that if it's all about science, well, then you got to do whatever it takes to fund the science, because science, the economics and science never did get along. You know, you can look at what happened here.
Please call your congressperson.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying that science and physics and the money people, the bean counters, they never did get along. So let me ask you this. If NASA were to be properly funded, what kind of things could they be doing that they aren't now, and how would that be a benefit to us?
Oh, man, imagination is the limit. Honestly, the things that we were doing, like we went to the moon the last time NASA was properly funded. Mm-hmm. We did that in something like 8 years. We could go all sorts of places. We could have spacecraft that have gone to planets that we've never properly visited. The last time we went to past Neptune as a planet was in 1989. We haven't been back. We could go do all sorts of stuff. It would be super cool.
So what would it would be super cool, but for people that are concerned with, you know, right near congressmen and taxes and spending and so forth, what would we gain from that?
So one of the things that came out of the push the moon race was smaller computers, which pretty directly led to our phones being as powerful as they are. Because prior to needing to send computers to the moon, because we needed something on board that could do, like, control the rocket, computers were enormous. They were the size of a room. But that obviously wouldn't fly if we were going to put it on a spacecraft and send it to the moon with astronauts as also on board. So it was really a push to make technology faster and better and smaller and lighter. And so we get that kind of return every time we do a new mission, is that there's new technology that's invented out of necessity that then comes through and becomes part of daily life. So the fact that we have a phone, like our phones are more powerful now than the computer that was on board that sent astronauts to the moon, and they just live in our pocket. It's pretty neat. But we get that every time there's a new mission.
So is there more opportunity for that type of advancement, or, well, I guess I'm trying to figure out the scientific part of it, the physics of it, the electronics of it. Where do we go from here?
So, for example, if we want to send people back to the moon, we know that there's issues with radiation once you leave near Earth. And so if we wanted to really send people to the moon to be there for more than 3 days, we would have to develop better ways of dealing with radiation, which would have really direct impacts on people going through cancer treatments on Earth, because we have radiation therapy as a way of dealing with cancer treatments. But part of the problem with radiation therapy is it sort of leaks and it gets into places we don't actually want. So if we can find better ways of controlling radiation, it might genuinely impact cancer treatments on Earth. And things like that, I think, are the next frontier. It may not make your phone much smaller, but it might make your quality of life much better if you get unwell.
Well, for the people that are in space on the International Space Station, we're supposed to come down. How long do they stay up there, and do we know what effect that has on the human body?
We've done a lot of studies on what the astronauts go through if they're up there for a long time. I think the current record holder is something over a year. And we did a twin study even with the Kelly brothers, who are twins, and they're both astronauts, and one stayed up on the ISS for a while, and the other one was on the ground, and they watched how their bodies changed. The main thing is that it makes your muscles really weak because you're fighting gravity all the time. Mm-hmm. And so they have to do a lot of exercise up there just to maintain muscle tone. And it's part of why when you see them come back down, they're often in a chair, and it's because they're a little weaker than they expect to be. They lose a lot of muscle tone while they're up there.
It's hard to do any resistance training because of the lack of gravity. Accurate or not?
Yeah, so they get bungee corded to a treadmill. That's one of the ways that they keep their leg muscles strong, is that there's like a shoulder strap that holds them down to the treadmill. And then with the steps that they take, they have to push up against the bungees. It's a really funny looking contraption.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to our friend, Dr. Jillian Scudder, Associate Professor of Physics Astronomy at Oberlin College, author of three books on astronomy for the general public. I don't know if you've seen this program, Three Body Problem, or not, but it does bring up a lot of questions about the Fermi paradox, about the theory of relativity. I know China was, as I understand it, Mao Zedong was opposed to that. I'm not quite sure why. And maybe you don't know what the theory of relativity is, but we'll find out when we come back. 504-260-1870. If you got any questions or comments, we're keeping you updated on the latest on the tropical disturbance down in the Gulf. As soon as we know anything more, we'll pass it along to you. But the timeline is probably Wednesday, Thursday, Category 1, somewhere between Lafayette and New Orleans, is what they're thinking right now, or between Lake Charles and New Orleans, primarily Lafayette. Taking a break, coming back, WWL.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
PDF up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port and trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
This time of year, the gear means more. The logo has a season of grit stitched in. The hat brims go low. The jerseys blaze with postseason pride. It's postseason season. This is what players and fans wear to win. Visit MLBShop.com for your favorite team gear and today's special offer. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
9:29, talking to Dr. Jillian Scudder, our friend, associate professor of physics, astronomy at Oberlin College, author of three books on astronomy for the general public. The storm is in the Gulf, and hurricane hunters are investigating, and they're saying it might affect us by Wednesday or Thursday, or it would be Wednesday or Thursday intensification. They don't know. Peyton Malone said something maybe could go to a Category 2, Category 1. Tidal concerns, rain concerns. Bottom line is, we don't know yet, but as soon as we do, we'll pass it along to you. Dr. Jillian Scudder, I got to ask you, what do you do? And I'm not, I don't mean this disrespectfully at all, believe me, but like, what do you do every day? Do you look at a telescope? Look at that. I didn't see that before. What do you do? How does an associate professor of physics and astronomy from the research side of it spend their day?
So most of my day is actually spent teaching. So the associate professor side of my job takes over a lot more, especially during the semester. So just before speaking with you, I was actually in class. I was teaching introductory physics to about 50 students. And that's where the majority. Thank you. It's going very well. So from, you know, September through December, that's where most of my time goes. But when I do have time to do research, I try and reserve like an afternoon or something for research. It's programming. I sit down with my computer and I try and get my computer programs to run. So I'm writing my own code and I am using that to figure out patterns in, a really large data set. It looks very much like data analysis for any other metric. It's just that my numbers mean something about outer space. But yeah, mostly programming. I don't live in a telescope. It would be cool, but I don't.
Are you doing that too?
The telescope observations?
No. The programming. Are you doing that as well? Because that's what I'm doing. That's what I spend my weekend doing.
Yeah, I'm programming. That's what my research
exact
is.
Thing. Yeah, absolutely. I was doing the exact same thing. Watching football. So let's talk about the Fermi paradox. Is that what they call it?
That's one of the things,
Because I've been watching this program, again, this the three-body problem, and there were a lot of things that made me think of you that came up, and I thought I'd ask you about it. What is the Fermi paradox for people that don't know?
Fermi paradox is the idea that if life is relatively common, so assuming that we're not particularly special, then it's odd that we haven't seen any other signs of life in our galaxy. Because if it is common and there are a lot of planets, then there should be other civilizations or signs of life somewhere, and yet we have not seen any evidence of it. So that's the paradox. And the resolution to the paradox is either it's not as common as we think, or space is big.
There is no east, west, north, or south when it comes to space, is there?
Not really, no. You can create coordinate systems that make some sense, but once you get out of the galaxy, it gets pretty tricky to do any of that. So, yeah, there's not really any intrinsic directionality anywhere.
So what would happen if I were to just be in space right now and not have any, not be in a capsule or anything else? What would it be like? Would there be any wind? Would there be any noise? Would there be any, what do you have any idea what it would be like?
Yeah, so, well, it would be lethal as the first thing it would be.
Because of what?
But there's no, because it's extremely cold and extremely, there's no atmospheric pressure. So your body would not hold up particularly well to either of those two things.
So what, the cold, how cold is it?
The depth of space is pretty close to absolute zero. The average temperature of the universe is 3 degrees Kelvin, so that's minus 270 degrees Celsius, mm-hmm. so minus 600-ish Fahrenheit.
So what about on a moon, for example?
So the when the moon is in shadow, it's minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit, Celsius, somewhere in there, okay. ish.
It's cold.
Real cold. And then it's 200 degrees in the sun. So it's a 400-degree temperature swing, which is not great for the human body or electronics, if we're being perfectly honest.
Yeah, you'd get a hell of a tando, wouldn't you?
Yes, very quickly. So yeah, if you're in direct sunlight near where we are relative to the sun, it gets very hot very quickly. And if you're in shade, then it gets very cold also very quickly.
So getting back to the Fermi paradox and whether or not any type of life has visited us, is there any way that could have been kept us? And I know this is not really a scientific question, but it would seem to me this would be a pretty hard secret to keep.
Yeah, it would be a very difficult secret to keep. And there are actually policies in place for what to do if a scientist does think that they have discovered some kind of extraterrestrial intelligence. And step three, immediately after, back up your data and get other people to check your work, is tell people. So it is not meant to be kept a secret.
Really? And who set those rules up?
It's an international consortium, actually. It's an agreement. It's not binding for like private corporations, but it is part of an international agreement of like for scientists working on the search. Tell people is step three.
I'm not big into conspiracy theories at all, and I always like to try to debunk them when I can. And when it comes to things like Roswell and Area 51 and all this kind of stuff, you can and unexplained aerial phenomena. What do I call them now? Unexplained aerial phenomenon, is that what they call them?
I think so, yeah.
One person is watching the other, is watching the other, is watching the other. So there's no way this could be kept a secret. I mean, what when you, as a trained professor of physics and astronomy, when you see these unexplained aerial phenomenon, what do you attribute them to?
It's either confidential military activity or the atmosphere is weird and we don't fully understand it.
Meaning?
So there are a lot of odd things that can happen in the atmosphere. You get weird static electricity effects. You get strange forms of lightning. You get like aurora. Sometimes people just don't recognize what they're looking at. So like aurora can be really strange. Sometimes you get like rocket exhaust that's lit up by a setting sun, but it glows later than sunset because it's so high in the atmosphere. So it can be all sorts of weird things. But there's a really weird atmospheric phenomenon that has that's like called sprites. Mm-hmm. And they're just red. They look like inverted lightning, and they go up instead of down towards the ground. But they're bright red. And they're really weird. We don't fully understand how they happen, but we have pictures of them. We know they're there. And so I think there's probably a fair amount of things like that where something physical is happening just with our atmosphere and the interface between that and space or just clouds and static electricity. Or it's a rocket that nobody wanted to talk about.
I lived in Las Vegas for a while, and going to work one morning at like 3:30, I saw some green lights moving up and down and all over the place, and this was like no aircraft I had ever seen. I just presumed they were screwing around with something at Nellis. So that's what you're saying, that kind of thing, military applications. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 9:38:22 till 10, talking to Dr. Jillian Scudder. Somebody's texting in about satellites and how susceptible are they to being shut down or in some way compromised by somebody else. We'll talk about that and more when we return. 9:43, 17 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL, spending an hour with Dr. Jillian Scudder, as we do occasionally, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Oberlin College, author of three books on astronomy for the general public. And, you know, we got this storm down there that we're watching, Dr. Scudder. How important are weather satellites in meteorology as it relates to the world and crop predictions and these kind of things?
Oh, they're critical. They give us a global view of what's going on with the weather. And it's one of the easiest ways for us to spot systems that are forming. So almost all of these satellite views where you see the entire Atlantic and then these storms that are starting to form, that information is coming from some kind of weather satellite that's orbiting the Earth. And so we get that early warning rather than just being blindsided by something a week in advance, go, okay, we can see it coming. We can keep an eye on that. And then we have 2 weeks of watching it and being able to see, oh, this storm is behaving like a previous one that we saw. That might get strong. Or like, this one doesn't look so organized. That one might not be so bad. So it gives us a lot of information.
So I try to wrap my head around this, these satellites orbiting, and you know, again, there's no northeast, west, south, but they do go around the Earth. And I don't know if there's, how do they decide what goes where, and how big of a problem is it that they have so many of these things up there? How many, do you know how many satellites, or do we know how many satellites are orbiting the Earth?
Oh, NASA does know. I don't know offhand. I think it's in the tens to hundreds of thousands, though.
So how do you keep from running into each other?
Well, one thing is that a lot of them orbit at different heights, So there's a little bit more space than it feels like there maybe should be. So GPS satellites are really far out from the Earth. It's, you know, tens of thousands of miles. Mm-hmm. But they orbit over one spot on the Earth, so they just sort of stay fixed relative to, like, some kind of overhead, or relatively so anyways. Then there are near-Earth satellites, and those ones are much closer in. Those are starting to get crowded, especially with the satellites for internet access, which multiple companies are putting up at the moment. And then in between, we have things like, you know, where the ISS orbits, and a little bit further out, we have the weather satellites, which are meant to orbit, those go usually north-south, so over the poles, and then they just rotate which part of the Earth they can see. As the Earth spins underneath it. There's a three-dimensionality to it. You have to think of it more like fish in the sea and less like ships on the surface.
So is there any kind of satellite traffic control that monitors or regulates all of this?
Yeah, NASA has a satellite monitoring system, and so they do have to be able to avoid each other occasionally. And so every so often, like, the entire International Space Station has to move because there's a satellite that is coming a little too close for comfort. There is a tracking system. We actually also track all of the little pieces of space debris, little chunks of, like, screws and, you know, pieces of broken satellite and other things that have flown off. And anything that's bigger than about the size of a golf ball, I think, is tracked.
Really?
Yeah. So we've got a lot of information about where things are.
So how damaging could that be? If you got something the size of a baseball traveling through space or in orbit, how fast is that going, and could that wreak havoc on whatever it ran into?
It would absolutely wreak havoc on anything it ran into. They're moving at thousands of miles an hour. It is destructive up there. So you really don't want things to run into anything else if you can help it at all.
All right, somebody texted in, why are we going back to the moon? Why is that important?
Well, if we want to go anywhere else, the moon is a good stepping stone. It will teach us all of the problems that we need to overcome. And if there are problems, it's easier to get people back home than it is if we're trying to send people to, say, Mars. And I think there's a lot we could learn from the moon just on the terms of, like, scientifically. We've only been there a handful of times. We only sent a geologist one time. Mm-hmm. He had a great time while he was there, but sending a planetary scientist or an Earth scientist there to pick up interesting rocks would be great. We've only done that the once. Otherwise, we had test pilots trying to pick up interesting rocks, and they're just not as well trained to be able to find the ones that are maybe the most interesting. So we could learn about a lot about the formation of the moon. But yeah, if we want to go anywhere else that isn't the Earth at any point, the moon is the safest place to send people.
So if these places are, how long does it take to get to Mars?
Somewhere between one and 3 years. Yeah, somewhere between 1 and 3 years, depending on where the Mars is in its orbit.
All right, so beyond that, space travel is as fast as it's going to get with, I don't know if they got these solar sails or not, or how do you do this?
So the problem, so solar sails exist, and you can send things on a solar sail, but it has to be pretty light, because the amount it can speed up by depends on how heavy the object is. And so the lighter your object, the faster the solar sail can go.
So what is the sail?
You can do cool stuff with the solar.
What is the sail capturing? Because there's no wind, right?
It's basically the particles that are flowing away from the sun. It's called the solar wind. It's not a wind in the sense that we experience it on Earth, but it's little bits of stuff that the sun has ejected from its surface and that are flowing out through the solar system. And they basically bounce off of the sail, and some of it is just the reflected light bounces off the sail, and it's enough just gently pushing impacts on the sail that it pushes the sail forward.
So I guess what I'm wondering, Doctor, and this is going to, you know, sound like it's coming from a kid, because that's basically what I am, but how could we ever, if it's light years away, where could we, well, like, what's the next planet next to Mars?
After Mars is Jupiter.
How far away is that?
It's about 5 astronomical units, so 5 times further out from the sun than the Earth is. So we're dealing with 93 million miles per astronomical unit, so 5 of those.
So how many years would it take to get there?
Oh, probably on the order of 5 to 8.
Okay, so you can't live there when you get there, right? I'm just playing devil's advocate here and trying to figure out.
No, you can't. Jupiter's terrible. You might be able to go to one of the moons, but even then it would be no more hospitable than our moon.
So why do it, I guess, is what people are wondering.
Well, it's one of these things. I think humans are explorers, and we do like to go places and learn new things. And if it is a way of pushing our technology forward and also learning new things, that's a good set of reasons. But I think a lot of places that we would like to go are honestly better served by sending robotic craft where there's no human life involved. So you don't have to worry about a robot getting cancer in the same way that you have to worry about a human if you send them out for 8 years and then interplanetary journey. And it will function. You can send it faster because it doesn't have a squishy human body inside, and it will operate probably more reliably. But some of it is just, yeah, it would be neat.
Somebody texted this in. I think it's an interesting question. Of all of the scientific thing and science fiction things that you've seen on television, you know, I'm telling you about this third body problem that I'm watching, and mm-hmm. there are other. Is there anything that seemed realistic to you at all, or is it all just, does it make you giggle when you look at it like, well, yeah, nice try, but that's not even close?
It depends on what it is. I think there's usually like an aspect that is realistic, and how much that's been made core to the story, it depends on what you're watching. So, for instance, Interstellar had a really good description of how time dilation works. But, you know, then there are other aspects of that story that aren't so sensible. I thought Arrival had a really interesting story, but the travel aspect of it, not so realistic.
Do you have Netflix?
No, I don't.
All right. Well, it's a book as well. Try Three Body Problem. I'd like to know what you think of it. Thank you.
I've heard good things about the book.
Okay, good. Thanks, Dr. Scudder. A pleasure as always. Dr. Jillian Scudder, Associate Professor of Physics Astronomy at Oberlin College, author of 3 books on astronomy for the general public. You can find them at all the usual outlets. Just Google Jillian Scudder, S-C-U-D-D-E-R. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for us when we come back on WWL. We return 9. 9:43, 17 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL, spending an hour with Dr. Jillian Scudder, as we do occasionally, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Oberlin College, author of three books on astronomy for the general public. And, you know, we got this storm down there that we're watching, Dr. Scudder. How important are weather satellites in meteorology as it relates to the world and crop predictions and these kind of things?
Oh, they're critical. They give us a global view of what's going on with the weather. And it's one of the easiest ways for us to spot systems that are forming. So almost all of these satellite views where you see the entire Atlantic and then these storms that are starting to form, that information is coming from some kind of weather satellite that's orbiting the Earth. And so we get that early warning rather than just being blindsided by something a week in advance, go, okay, we can see it coming. We can keep an eye on that. And then we have 2 weeks of watching it and being able to see, oh, this storm is behaving like a previous one that we saw. That might get strong. Or like, this one doesn't look so organized. That one might not be so bad. So it gives us a lot of information.
So I try to wrap my head around this, these satellites orbiting, and you know, again, there's no northeast, west, south, but they do go around the Earth. And I don't know if there's, how do they decide what goes where, and how big of a problem is it that they have so many of these things up there? How many, do you know how many satellites, or do we know how many satellites are orbiting the Earth?
Oh, NASA does know. I don't know offhand. I think it's in the tens to hundreds of thousands, though.
So how do you keep from running into each other?
Well, one thing is that a lot of them orbit at different heights, mm-hmm. so there's a little bit more space than it feels like there maybe should be. So GPS satellites are really far out from the Earth. It's, you know, tens of thousands of miles. Mm-hmm. But they orbit over one spot on the Earth, so they just sort of stay fixed relative to, like, some kind of overhead, or relatively so anyways. Then there are near-Earth satellites, and those ones are much closer in. Those are starting to get crowded, especially with the satellites for internet access, which multiple companies are putting up at the moment. And then in between, we have things like, you know, where the ISS orbits, and a little bit further out, we have the weather satellites, which are meant to orbit. Those go usually north-south, so over the poles, and then they just rotate which part of the Earth they can see. As the Earth spins underneath it. There's a three-dimensionality to it. You have to think of it more like fish in the sea and less like ships on the surface.
So is there any kind of satellite traffic control that monitors or regulates all of this?
Yeah, NASA has a satellite monitoring system, and so they do have to be able to avoid each other occasionally. And so every so often, like, the entire International Space Station has to move because there's a satellite that is coming a little too close for comfort. There is a tracking system. We actually also track all of the little pieces of space debris, little chunks of, like, screws and, you know, pieces of broken satellite and other things that have flown off. And anything that's bigger than about the size of a golf ball, I think, is tracked.
Really?
So we've got a lot of information about where things are.
So how damaging could that be if you got something the size of a baseball traveling through space or in orbit? How fast is that going, and could that wreak havoc on whatever it ran into?
It would absolutely wreak havoc on anything it ran into. They're moving at thousands of miles an hour. It is destructive up there. So you really don't want things to run into anything else if you can help it at all.
All right, somebody texted in, why are we going back to the moon? Why is that important?
Well, if we want to go anywhere else, the moon is a good stepping stone. It will teach us all of the problems that we need to overcome. And if there are problems, it's easier to get people back home than it is if we're trying to send people to, say, Mars. And I think there's a lot we could learn from the moon just on the terms of, like, scientifically. We've only been there a handful of times. We only sent a geologist one time. Mm-hmm. He had a great time while he was there, but sending a planetary scientist or an Earth scientist there to pick up interesting rocks would be great. We've only done that the once. Otherwise, we had test pilots trying to pick up interesting rocks, and they're just not as well trained to be able to find the ones that are maybe the most interesting. So we could learn a lot about the formation of the moon. But yeah, if we want to go anywhere else that isn't the Earth at any point, the moon is the safest place to send people.
So if these places are, how long does it take to get to Mars?
Somewhere between one and three years. Yeah, somewhere between 1 and 3 years, depending on where the Mars is in its orbit.
All right, so beyond that, space travel is as fast as it's going to get with, I don't know if they got these solar sails or not, or how do you do this?
So the problem, so solar sails exist, and you can send things on a solar sail, but it has to be pretty light because the amount it can speed up by depends on how heavy the object is. And so the lighter your object, the faster the solar sail can go.
So what is the sail?
You can do cool stuff with the solar.
What is the sail capturing? Because there's no wind, right?
It's basically the particles that are flowing away from the sun. It's called the solar wind. It's not a wind in the sense that we experience it on Earth, but it's little bits of stuff that the sun has ejected from its surface and that are flowing out through the solar system. And they basically bounce off of the sail, and some of it is just the reflected light bounces off the sail, and it's enough just gently pushing impacts on the sail that it pushes the sail forward.
So I guess what I'm wondering, Doctor, and this is going to, you know, sound like it's coming from a kid because that's basically what I am, but how could we ever, if it's light years away, where could we, well, like, what's the next planet next to Mars?
After Mars is Jupiter.
How far away is that?
It's about 5 astronomical units, so 5 times further out from the sun than the Earth is. So we're dealing with 93 million miles per astronomical unit, so 5 of those.
So how many years would it take to get there?
Oh, probably on the order of 5 to 8.
Okay, so you can't live there when you get there, right? I'm just playing devil's advocate here and trying to figure out.
No, you can't. Jupiter's terrible. You might be able to go to one of the moons, but even then it would be no more hospitable than our moon.
So why do it, I guess, is what people are wondering.
Well, it's one of these things. I think humans are explorers, and we do like to go places and learn new things. And if it is a way of pushing our technology forward and also learning new things, that's a good set of reasons. But I think a lot of places that we would like to go are honestly better served by sending robotic craft where there's no human life involved. So you don't have to worry about a robot getting cancer in the same way that you have to worry about a human if you send them out for 8 years and then interplanetary journey. And it will function. You can send it faster because it doesn't have a squishy human body inside, and it will operate probably more reliably. But some of it is just, yeah, it would be neat.
Somebody texted this in. I think it's an interesting question. Of all of the scientific thing and science fiction things that you've seen on television, you know, I'm telling you about this third body problem that I'm watching and mm-hmm. your other. Is there anything that seemed realistic to you at all, or is it all just, does it make you giggle when you look at it like, well, yeah, nice try, but that's not even close?
It depends on what it is. I think there's usually like an aspect that is realistic, and how much that's been made core to the story, it depends on what you're watching. So, for instance, Interstellar had a really good description of how time dilation works. But, you know, then there are other aspects of that story that aren't so sensible. I thought Arrival had a really interesting story, but the travel aspect of it, not so realistic.
Do you have Netflix?
No, I don't.
All right. Well, it's a book as well. Try Three Body Problem. I'd like to know what you think of it. Thank you.
I've heard good things about the book.
Okay, good. Thanks, Dr. Scudder. A pleasure as always. Dr. Jillian Scudder, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Oberlin College, author of 3 books on astronomy for the general public. You can find them at all the usual outlets. Just Google Jillian Scudder, S-C-U-D-D-E-R. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for us when we come back on WWL. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
It's time for Pitch Hit and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Give the kids in your community a chance to flex their superpowers and they could earn a trip to the national finals of the 2025 World Series presented by Capital One. So go ahead, be the one who powers their dreams and sign up to host the local Pitch Hit and Run event. It's a free and fun way to promote baseball, softball, and your organization. To learn more, go to pitchhitrun.com.